Hello and welcome back to CoronaCast. I'm Hannah Harris.
And I'm Tilly.
And I'm a GP in South London, and Tilly's my daughter who's an actor. And we've been making CoronaCast for the last few months since coronavirus started in this country. So it's about all things corona, from people's stories and experiences to interviews with experts and some health advice from me as well. I'm just going to start with my disclaimer. I'm a GP. I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. Opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
Sorry, it's been a couple of weeks since our last episode. We had a couple of technical hitches, which are now all sorted. So we can't wait for you to listen to this episode today.
Yeah. And so in this podcast, we talk a lot about medicine, but we also talk a lot about the arts because they're both passions of ours. And in this episode, our guest is theatre director and friend Raz Shaw.
Yeah, he has directed many plays over the years, mainly in London and Manchester.
One of Raz's long-standing collaborators is actress Julie Hesmondhalge, who he directed in a play called Wit at Manchester Royal Exchange in 2016. And he was awarded Best Director at the UK Theatre Awards for that production.
He also directed Julie in a one-woman show called The Greatest Play in the History of the World, written for her by her husband, Ian Kershaw. We actually saw that one, didn't we? It was really good.
In Manchester. It was brilliant.
Yeah. They took it to the Edinburgh Fringe and then Manchester and most recently London to great acclaim.
Raz is also a lover of musical theatre and he directed a musical for the first time in 2018, The Producers, again in Manchester, and the show was listed in The Guardian's top 10 shows of the year.
2 years ago, Raz turned his hand to writing and wrote a book called Death and the Elephant, How Cancer Saved My Life, which we speak about in this interview quite a lot. It's about how he had both cancer and a gambling addiction in his 20s.
And how he dealt with that. And we talk about all of those things, as well as the fact that Raz has been shielding for the last 12 weeks because of his vulnerability to coronavirus. So we can't wait for you to hear this interview.
Yep, we're going to cut the chat and just get on with it today. And we hope you love Raz as much as we do. Over to Raz.
It's a joy to welcome you here, Raz. Hi.
Well, it's a joy to be here. Hi, guys.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
So how are you? How are you coping with being at home on your own all this time?
I've been on my own at home for almost 30 years. So
another 10 weeks is neither here nor there.
So it's really not too bad. I mean, it's genuinely that is part of the thing. I think you have to find the positive in these things. And I do live alone and I have lived alone, I mean, most of the time for 30 years. And therefore, the only difference, I mean, there's a lot of differences, obviously. But essentially, isolation means cooking for yourself. It means looking after yourself. It means keeping yourself occupied. All those things which I have spent the last 30 years doing. So in some fashion, apart from, you know, the obvious thing of no actual human contact, although I have a little front garden with railings out to the street and I'm in the basement. So if you're standing at the railings, you're looking down into my little front garden. It's kind of like my prison. I mean, it'd be quite nice to have a prison outdoors, but people come and pass by. So I call it the railings bar. And up until now, I've got a few friends who live quite close and they come pass by sometimes on their own or sometimes with their two-year-old kid. And we have a chat, but they weren't breaking any rules. They were passing by as they were going for a walk.
Yeah.
Now I don't know what the rules are. Are they allowed to stop? I don't know.
We're not really sure, are we?
Who knows? So that's been nice. And obviously, the other thing that one didn't have up until a while back, even in my 30 years of living alone, is technology.
Yes. Zoom.
I mean, the Zoom lethargy is kicking in big time.
Yeah.
I mean, all these people who didn't want to speak to me for 30 years now want me to join their Zoom party.
I know. All these people come out of the woodwork.
Which is very nice. I'm not complaining, but I am complaining.
Yeah, I've complained quite a few times, actually, about Zoom fatigue.
Sometimes it's nice to have the choice, isn't it? It's nice to have the choice to say, thank you very much for the offer of joining your quiz. But I'd much rather watch normal people.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely what we would say every time.
Every time.
Exactly. But hey, it is a godsend, you know, and to be able to see people, which makes up in some ways for being completely on my own for 2.5 months or whatever it is. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It sounds like you're actually veritably enjoying.
I think you've got to use it. And also, in my normal life as a director, I'm always out having meetings. So I'll nip into town, I have a meeting at 2 o'clock, and then I might have another meeting at 4:30. So I'll sort of go into a cafe and pretend to do some work. And if I'm writing something, sort of pretend to write something, but actually be on Google or whatever. And there's so much time that you waste. And the fact that you can't have, even if I wasn't an at-risk person, I wouldn't be getting on the tube to have a meeting in town anyway. And it means that I've got time to do lots of things I always wanted to do. Like,
yeah, of course. You know, so you've got the luxury of time now.
Yeah, luxury of time and organising and all that kind of stuff. So I'm getting a lot done. And I'm also watching rubbish TV at the same time. So it's kind of win-win.
Perfect. Heaven, yeah, in fact.
Sounds good.
Heaven.
So you were saying there about you were a director. What's it been like going from, in my mind, quite a hands-on job to suddenly being thrust into isolation? How are you getting on with that?
It's a good question, Tilly. I love it. Don't have to deal with actors. I mean,
oh my goodness.
The real truth is, as a director anyway, I mean, I probably do 2 or 3 shows a year, no more than that, you know, and therefore in terms of directing. So actually in that year, I'm probably in a room with actors for only 8 or 10 weeks of that year, maybe a bit more, or maybe less sometimes, depending on what's going on in that particular year. And so, I mean, that's the sort of myth. My mum used to say, which always make me laugh, and a lot of directors and actors will have experienced this, which is, she's like, well, what do you do with your time when you're not working? And I was like, Mother, I'm always working. I'm just not always in a rehearsal room.
Yeah.
So actually, luckily, this year, it was always, in some fashion, a preparation year for 2 big shows that I was supposed to be doing next year. And it was also a year that I'd earmarked to try and write a first draft of another book. And so actually...
Fortuitous then.
Yeah, I mean, it's fortuitous in a way. In development of these 2 shows, I was weirdly going to spend a lot of time in rehearsals or in a rehearsal room workshopping these shows. But actually, fortuitously, in terms of the shows itself, I wasn't going to be in rehearsals for them. And I'd also set out to try and write in some fashion a first draft of a new book. But so it could have been worse. Now it looks like those 2 big shows next year are going to happen in 2022. So I've got even more time to write my book. Yeah,
they're bumped for a year.
Yeah, well, one of them was due to open in January and I can't see anything. It's a really tricky time because who's going to be the guinea pig that goes, we'll open first. We'll see if audiences want to come and sit shoulder to shoulder with another coughing person. And if audiences want to come. And I think the notion that this government might have that you can social distance everything, the idea that you can social distance theatres is, in far as I'm concerned, nonsense. A, financially, if a theatre, like I work at the Royal Exchange a lot in Manchester, and that holds 750 people, if you were going to socially distance in that theatre, you'd have to reduce it to about 250 people.
Yeah, max.
And the maths just don't work.
No.
You know, unless you're putting on a one-person show and you're just reducing your ambitions creatively and artistically and financially. And also, people don't want to sit in a theatre that's only a third full.
No.
I know you guys aren't particularly, and nor am I, fans of watching theatre online or on telly or whatever, because it doesn't work and it doesn't have the same feel and it always feels like a school play in some fashion.
So true.
But at the same time, I don't want to sit in a third full theatre and I don't want an audience to necessarily, out of choice, experience one of my shows in a third full theatre.
Yeah, and as an actor, you probably don't want to perform.
No, you don't. It's a tricky thing. But having said that, as an actor, you'll want to do anything you can right now.
Yeah.
So it's a contradiction.
Sure. And as time goes on, it really is looking like theatre is one of the biggest casualties of this pandemic in terms of kind of industries, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the Nuffield in Southampton have already gone into administration, yeah. which is awful. And and there's a lot of theatres who are clinging on by their fingertips. Yeah. And theatres that you wouldn't imagine, you know, because most theatres don't have reserves.
No.
Or they have limited reserves for the next show. Mm. And Regent's Park just announced that they're moving the whole season to next year, which is great. And they've done very well by building up a reserve to enable them financially to do that. But, you know, it's not about forward thinking. It's just about existing for most theatres. You know?
Sure. Even the Old Vic has reported that it hasn't got reserves to last for a lot longer.
It's a tricky thing. And some theatres, like the Old Vic, definitely like the Globe, don't get government subsidy.
No.
And so a huge amount of their, you know, turnover is based on box office income.
Yeah.
And so it's really difficult.
Yeah, it's a really worrying time.
The most worrying thing isn't really, because theatre will happen again at some point. It's just about people's livelihoods.
Yeah.
You know, it's about, I'm hearing now about, you know, hardship funds for actors and creatives and people who, most people do work hand to mouth, however successful you are. Because if you're successful, you're probably spending the fairly decent income that you're earning anyway. So you're still working hand to mouth. It doesn't necessarily equate because you have a profile or you're a very successful creative, you know, designer or director or whatever, that you've got reserves of money yourself, because you probably don't. And therefore, this is an unprecedented time where lighting designers go and work as delivery drivers in Tesco's and things like that, which is amazing that people go, no, I've got to earn a living, I've got a family to pay for or whatever, and go and do these things. But it just means that the hardest thing is about people's livelihoods.
Yeah, it's bringing out the resilience, isn't it, in sort of human nature. But it's a very sad and scary time.
This is an industry full of pretty hardy people. And financially at the moment, it's scary and it's difficult, and everyone is looking at different ways where they can, you know, exist. But it will bounce back properly. I mean, you know, even though I'm not a massive fan of like lockdown isolation stories, there's lots of that. There's lots of that going on, and good for people who are doing it because they're making the most of the situation they're in.
Yeah, and lots of writing. Because ironically, we were saying this a little bit in our interview with David Ganley, on the flip side, this whole time is showing how important theatre, TV, film are to people. You know, stories, watching, listening, you know, that's what's keeping everybody going.
Totally. It's no accident that a show like Normal People, which is a great book, which I love the book, and often a great book doesn't make a great TV series or play or musical or whatever, but it's really hit the moment, because actually, weirdly, it's a story about two quite isolated people who find each other, and, you know, they can't be together and they can't be apart. That's the sort of story. And it just feels like it's something that people need right now, that kind of, the mixture between the bleakness and the hope that's in it is sort of lands. And it is stories that keep us going in whatever fashion that is, be it theatre, be it telly, be it just reading a book, you know.
Yeah, it's something to get invested in.
Exactly. Because it's hard. Whether you live with your daughter or your mother, or you live sadly alone like a 52-year-old theatre director, you want the world to feel like it's as broad as we know it is, because sometimes when you're sitting in isolation, the world feels very small and limited. And stories help you realise that there's a life out there, a world out there that is happening, and we need to hold on till, and it will happen again.
It's so true. Stories give us hope.
That's beautiful.
Oh, so lovely. Beautiful, Raz Shaw. Thank you for that. Gem.
I'm full of gems.
So, you're full of positivity, actually. It doesn't sound like you're lonely at all.
Strangely unknown for someone who's not that positive. But actually, weirdly, and here's a confession I'm going to make live on your podcast, I've come to the conclusion within this pandemic that I might be positive. I might be a positive person.
I'm shocked by this, what I'm hearing.
I know, it's ridiculous. Anyone who listens to this won't actually be shocked by the notion of me being positive. They'll be shocked by the notion of me admitting it.
Yeah. Your friends are going to think you've been replaced by...
Well, exactly. I mean, even in the book that I wrote, I negated my positivity and I called it positivity by stealth or not being negative. So I didn't even want to call myself positive there. But
positively being negative.
I mean, this is maybe one thing I'm not at the moment is bored, because I think you have to keep stimulating your mind to keep going, to stop giving in to the madness of the situation we all live in, you know. And maybe that's me being positive. I don't know.
I think it is, Raz. Ooh. Positively is.
Oh, my life has changed.
If anything comes out of this for the world, Raz Shaw is now a positive person.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah, that can be our positive news for the episode as well.
Update.
So you're probably going to talk quite positively about this as well then.
Oh.
I was about you being on the high risk shielding list. If you don't mind us talking a bit about that.
Not at all.
Why you have ended up being on that high risk list. And I'd love to know, I'd really like to know how it feels to be told you're in that group.
I'm picturing ahead where I'm even more positive. But anyway, let's get there. So in a very brief nutshell, in December time, I started to feel unwell. And oddly, I started to feel, if I look back on it now, a lot of the COVID symptoms. I was texting and talking to you about it, Hannah, a little bit.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had flu, and I was directing a play at that time, or a play of mine was on, and the actor in it, Julie Hesmondhouse, was staying at my house, and she kept saying, "Oh, you look like death." And thanks very much. But yeah, and I couldn't catch my breath a little bit and was tired, but I just sort of ignore those things and get on with it. And then in the beginning of January, actually after Julie had left, so maybe it was her keeping me going, I think I texted you and said, "Oh, my breathing is really bad. I can hear a crackle in my lungs."
Yeah, you were like, "When I'm lying in bed at night, there's this rattling coming from the left side of my chest."
Yeah.
And when I went into the garden yesterday to get something from the shed, I got so dizzy that I had to sit down on my way back into the house.
Yeah, yeah. But even then,
it's like a 10-meter garden or something.
Yeah. Like, hang on, it's quite big.
Sorry.
But yeah, so even then I was like, "Oh, I'm sure I'll be fine." And Dr. Hannah was like, "Well, it sounds a little bit like pneumonia. You might want to take yourself to a hospital if you feel like it."
Tonight.
And I didn't. And so about 5 o'clock in the morning, having heard my chest rattle for about 2 hours, I was really annoyed by my chest because it was keeping me awake. And I thought, okay, maybe I'd give in to the genius that is Dr. Hannah. And therefore, I packed a little bag because, I was no hurry about this thing. I packed a bag. And then I did a very English thing, which is I phoned, is it 111?
Yeah.
I went on to 111 and typed in my symptoms. And it was like a cartoon. It came up with big red flashing things saying, "Call 999. And even then, that's when I sort of potted around packing a bag. And so then I called 999, and even on the phone, I was like, "I'm very, very English about the whole thing. I'm really sorry to bother you. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure it's nothing. I'm sure I don't want to be one of those people who just, brings out, I know you're really busy." And this is pre-COVID, obviously, just pre-COVID. And I said, "But these are my symptoms." And a lovely paramedic came within 10 minutes, and then he called an ambulance. And then within 20 minutes, I was being... Is it red lighted or blue lighted?
Blue lighted.
So then I was in resus and they diagnosed me with severe double pneumonia. I was taken to a ward, and when I was in the ward, I had... Now, is it a pulmonary edema? Is that what I...
Flash pulmonary edema. Yeah. So your lungs very quickly filled with a lot of fluid.
Yeah. And I couldn't... It was a really strange experience because... I have a history. I had cancer 25 years ago, and I wrote a book about the taboo or not of death. And death itself isn't, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, isn't something in itself that scares me. But I don't like not feeling well. So I couldn't breathe. And all these masks I kept sort of ripping off because they made me feel like claustrophobic. And I sort of was rushed into critical and given a mask called an Optiflow mask, and which pushed the air back into my lungs and calmed me down a bit. But then I had another of those attacks, flash attacks the next day, and they suspected, and then they found out it was true, that I had acute heart failure. They then diagnosed me, after being moved to cardiology after 5 days, with a thing called left ventricle dysfunction, which is a low pumping of the heart. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it means the left side of the heart, which pumps blood around the body, isn't pumping very efficiently.
So mine was pumping at 20%.
Yeah, which is very, very low. And it was incredible, really, because there'd been no sign of this before this infection that you had.
No, I was doing 5K in the gym 3 times a week.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh,
you were really fit.
Well, one of the things they discovered, which they think it was as a result. So 25 years ago, I had stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it was touch and go for a while then. And I had very heavy duty chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And the theory is that my heart was damaged from that.
By the chemotherapy. It's a known side effect of some chemotherapeutic agents. So right. I understand.
Yeah. And what I don't quite understand, maybe you would tell me, is whether it was damaged then and got worse, or right from that time 25 years ago, it was always at a 20% rate, or I don't really understand, that kind of thing.
I'm not totally sure, but I think there are side effects that, like when people smoke and then they get the lung disease a lot later. The effect happens years and years afterwards, and I think that's probably what happened with you. You haven't had heart failure for all of these years.
No.
I think that's true, although I'm not 100%, I have to say.
It's difficult to know how more out of breath I would have been if I hadn't had this and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you don't know whether you were always more breathless than the average person or not.
So, yeah, and that's how I came to be an at-risk person. Although, strangely, I'm not on the list, the government's list, and my cardiologist said I should be, but it's more political that people with some heart conditions aren't on the list, and she thinks they should be, so she's told me to treat it just as if I was. And all the things that people on the list can get, like delivery kind of stuff, I'm getting through other means and friends and stuff. So I don't need to be on that list for that purposes, and I don't want to take up other people's slots. And the question, I think, which is really difficult now, and I haven't been out at all, so I haven't been to any shop.
Have you not? You haven't left the house?
No, I've left the house. I've got a garden, which I'm very lucky about, according to you, a very small garden. And I was going to the woods a little bit. I live in Highgate and I've got, some nice woods. But I just didn't like the way other people were coming towards you and not getting out of the way and all that kind of stuff. And so about 3 weeks ago or 3 or 4 weeks ago, I made a decision not to go out. And then I felt like this is a bit crazy. So now, like a slightly eccentric person, I do Joe Wicks at 9 o'clock.
Do you?
Yeah, of course. With the nation. Love a bit of Joe.
Pee with Joe.
I do pee with Joe.
Well, that's what I started off with, but I've advanced now.
What have you advanced to?
Graduated.
I do his hit ones. Oh, like his normal hit ones.
Oh, they look really tough.
Yeah, they are.
Chilly. Are they 15 minutes?
You can do 15 minute, but he's also got 20 and 30 minute ones.
I know,
but
I'm going to do it.
You should do 15, because even though it's so hard, you can just say in your head, it's only 15 minutes.
It's only 15
Remember
minutes.
Remember Raz and his heart. Let's be careful.
Yeah, okay. No, yeah, maybe stick with Pee with Joe with the kids.
You'll collapse, but it's really good fun.
I mean, it's interesting. So now what I do is I do Joe with Wicks, Pee with Joe, and then I go for a walk on my road, which is only 150 yards long, up and down my road. So I look like a really strange, eccentric person who's walking up and down my road. And I do it to a different musical theatre album every day, because I'm very theatrical like that. And a theatre album is about 6,000 steps.
So you do it to the whole album?
the end of the album. And if it's a short album and it hasn't reached 6,000 steps, I'll go on to something else. And in fact, this morning, I have to tell you, this morning I decided I was listening to your latest podcast when you were talking to your drama school mates, and it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work on my walk. So I had to reduce myself from your podcast to Avenue Q. And I had to listen to it when I came home. Anyway, that's sort of what my routine is. And the interesting thing is when I first came out of hospital, my cardiologist didn't want me to do any kind of exercise, or very little, certainly not running. I went into a rehab, cardio rehab group, and we started to do exercise. And I felt a little bit out of breath for like pretty minimal exercise, which a few weeks before I was doing as a warm up, you know.
Yeah.
But she did say, you know, you can increase it. And then I had an echocardiogram where my LVD rate was up to 30, just under 35%. So
that's really quite improved from 20 to 35.
Yeah. So that's all quite positive. And therefore, I've pushed the PE with Joe a bit harder. And now I'm going to do the HIIT.
Yes. You should do it. What, did you find it difficult when she said you couldn't do exercise? Like, do you enjoy exercising?
No, I hate exercise, Tilly. I literally hate it.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I hate it. But I've learnt that I have to do it, A, for, you know, fitness, because I like my food, but also for mental health.
And 100%. Yeah, I agree.
Sometimes I wonder why, because I'm not really someone who gets particularly depressed a lot, but now and again have moments of lethargy or moments of being down or whatever. And if I think about it, almost always I realise I haven't been to the gym for a week. And, I have to trick myself even now, or even then when I was going to the gym, of going to the gym by pretending I wasn't, in order to get myself to leave the house.
And then, did you tell yourself you were going then?
Well, I don't know. I just get out the door.
The pub?
Going to the pub with my gym kit in a bag, and just get in your car. And then when you're in the car, just drive. And so once you're in the gym, you might as well just go for it. It's a getting to the gym.
That is supposed to be a way of dealing with, like, you know, chronic procrastination and, you know, difficulty getting around to things, is just do it in little bite-sized chunks.
I do that a lot. You kid yourself.
Yeah, me too.
Even though your conscience is telling you, I know when I'm walking out the door that I'm going to the gym, but the other part of me is saying you're just going out the door.
La 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 la.
I do that, yeah. With essays, I'll be like, well, I have to read the play before I can write the essay, so let me just read the play. And that doesn't mean I'm doing the essay.
No, well, exactly. But I do that with, also, Tilly, I do that with writing as well. I've realised that if you're going to, it's like, I mean, it's the same as running 5K. I can't go into a gym and say I'm going to run 5K because that's ridiculous. So I set myself 500 metres to run. And at the end of 500 metres, I go, oh, I might as well run another 500 metres. And it goes on like that.
Yeah.
With writing, if you stare at a blank page and go, I've got 100,000 words to write for a book, you will go mad. But if you just say, I'm just going to start to write 200 words. My friend, who a very close friend of mine, when I first wrote my book, she gave me two pieces of advice. One is an Ernest Hemingway piece of advice, which is don't get it right, get it written. And that means that you just write stuff on a page for the first draft and not worry about what it is. It's getting it on the page, because then you can change it. She writes Coronation Street and she says the second draft is always almost 98% changed. But at least there's something there. And the other piece of advice you give me is just set yourself 15 minutes a day to write. Now, you might end up writing for 6 hours, but 15 minutes a day is quite a long time. And so when I was writing that book and I was doing lots of, you know, theatre work at the same time, sometimes I'd come back at 11:30 at night and I'd just write 15 minutes. But it felt like you were moving forward every day. And you'd written 200 words and then suddenly you look on your word count and it's 3,000 words and suddenly you look and it's 7,000 words. And
yeah, you're getting more and more.
It's my advice to the nation.
Yeah, that's a bit like the philosophy I learnt from your friend Carrie Ad Lloyd.
Oh, yes.
Talking about, you know, the artist's way and the morning pages. And
yeah,
just
absolutely.
She got herself writing by just getting up in the morning, sitting down and writing three pages of whatever's in her head.
Because that is absolutely a brilliant way of doing things. And what's amazing about that, and I find even now writing, I was writing just before this conversation, is that most of my ideas come when I'm writing rather than thinking, oh, I've got this idea and I'm going to write it down. I'll start with an idea, and then as I'm writing, something else comes out during the writing, then something else comes out, which I would never have thought of just by sitting back and not writing.
Yeah, that's amazing. The writing kind of leads you. I heard Phoebe Waller-Bridge talking a bit like that. Like,
yeah,
people, writing is a kind of life form of itself.
Exactly. People call it, my friend Carl Gross is a brilliant writer who's written the musical that I'm going to do in now 2022. He always talks about writing your way into it rather than thinking you're into it. Just get it, just start, get writing, and then the thing will come, you know.
And so can you tell us a bit about what you're writing at the moment? What's your second book? Is it a secret?
No, it's not a secret, but it's, I've got lots of things I'd quite like to write. The first book is obviously about my brush with cancer, stage four cancer, as I said, in 1995, when just the day before my 28th birthday, I was diagnosed. I was also a gambling addict at the time and doing a job I didn't want to do, running a telesales company, when I knew I should be doing the job I do now. But the kind of the madness of being an addict and all that was, you know, driving me away from the thing I should be doing. And then I got cancer. And so my book is is called Death and the Elephant, How Cancer Saved My Life. And the reason it's subtitled that is because it was absolutely that made me see the light, made me realize the ridiculous of the life I was living, made me investigate, even though the year I was dealing with cancer, I was also fiercely gambling, but it made me wrestle at the end of it with the madness of gambling.
Amazing. It took something life-threatening.
Yes.
To sort of make you see the error of your ways.
So at the end of it, when I was given the all clear in March 96, a month, I then went on a binging gambling spree, I call it waving goodbye to the addiction. Because when I was ill, gambling and cancer were sort of fighting each other for my attention. So if I wasn't in a casino, I was in a hospital. And I always say that, you know, both of their intentions were particularly evil. So cancer's intention was to kill me, and so was gambling's. And so I was in the middle of it trying to fight for my life against these two behemoths. And so in March 96, when I was given the all clear from cancer, having been touch and go for a while, so I was stage four, with things like terrible side effects. I had 350 mouth ulcers at one time and all this kind of stuff. And then, so I went on a gambling binge for a month, which was waving goodbye to gambling. And then on April the 10th, 1996 was the last time I ever gambled, and I haven't gambled since. And then no accident, after taking a year out to recuperate, my career started at the National Theatre Studio at the old age of 30. But, you know, age is just a number, right?
Yeah, exactly. If it's what you're meant to be doing, then you should
exactly.
be there.
Exactly. I'm 52 years young.
Why your book is called Death and the Elephant? What's the elephant about?
So it's a good question. I come up with names and I don't really know why.
Okay.
The book is really about me saying, look, let's not bury our head in the sand about death. And in that particular instance, I was close to death. And what happens when you have cancer, especially the cancer word, and it's interesting now to compare it to COVID, is that, you know, if you say, I've got cancer, especially then, I mean, still now probably, people's immediate thought is death. And then people become very uncomfortable, often, quite understandably, sort of get tongue-tied, don't know what to say. And so the elephant in the room is death.
Got you.
And because of my inability to take myself in any way seriously, even when you have cancer, or even when you're in a hospital with double pneumonia and being told you've got a heart that's only working at 20%. Because of that, it's very easy for me to try and make it okay for other people to talk about. Because I think, weirdly, it's your job as the patient with a life-threatening illness, be it cancer and be it with the coronavirus, is to say to other people, it's okay, we can talk about it. Or not. We could sit here and talk about, you know, Bruce Springsteen or football, which are two things I'm quite happy to talk about for ages. or we can talk about death and cancer. The elephant in the room is the taboo subject that I spent my time when I had cancer trying to sort of burst.
Yeah. And you talk a lot about that in the book, actually, don't you? About your kind of your visitors and managing them and their fears and their expectations.
Yeah.
Because you're the one who's much more comfortable. And I made a rule when I had cancer that I didn't want anyone visiting me in hospital who I wouldn't want to visit me when I was well. Because you're the one who's making all the effort.
But it's often what happens.
Yeah. And they mean so well. And in my book, quite meanly, I call them delusionals. I call them people who think they're visiting you because you will like it, but you won't.
And they're actually doing it for them.
They're doing it for them. And it's understandable. I sound like an awful person. But,
it's good to talk about these things, Raz.
I think it's understandable why they're doing it. For instance, my mother was in a hospice for the last 10 days of her life. And obviously, she was very ill. And she had lots of people visiting who shouldn't have been there, really, because she was sort of out of it. I became the gatekeeper to the visitors because I thought there's no point in some of these people. But they were so well-meaning. But they were sort of doing it because they themselves were in pain about the thought of my mother dying. I say in the book, think twice, think three times and think, will this person actually want me there? And if you think after three times the answer is yes, think again for the fourth time. Even this time when I was in critical, I was very careful about the people I wanted to come visit me because it's really tiring.
Yeah.
And talking about the coronavirus, when you're out of breath and you're on a machine, it's really tiring to have visitors. And obviously it's different now because people don't have visitors, sadly.
Yeah, yeah. But it does wipe you out because you have to kind of perform a little bit.
And because it's me, and obviously as people are getting to realize in this very long 30-minute segment, I can talk for England, and therefore I find it hard not to perform.
Yeah, you like talking,
you know, and that's really tiring.
Yep. And I wonder if you did have COVID-19. That's the other thing we didn't mention earlier.
Yeah,
maybe you had the other big C as well.
Maybe, although my cardiologist, I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago, and she looked up all the kind of different configurations of the pneumonia in the lungs and whatever. I don't really understand it. And she said it doesn't really equate with the same patterns as COVID.
And your blood results would have given quite a lot of clues as well.
When I was in cardiology and I was out of critical, they came up towards the end before I was discharged. They came up at one point and said, oh, this was like 8 days after I was admitted. They came up and said, oh, well, we've just ruled out influenza. Mm. So they were still looking for the cause of it. So
it'll be interesting to see if you have the antibodies.
Yeah, I say the antibody test is one of those weird tests whereby you want it to be positive. You know, sometimes I go for other tests of things and get sent a text and I don't want them to be positive. And thankfully, that's they've true. All been negative. And now you're looking for it to be positive.
Yeah.
It's not completely certain, is it, Hannah, that if you've got the antibodies that you're definitely immune.
Yeah, that they confer immunity. Exactly. We don't know that for sure anyway.
But it would make me breathe more easily. It's, pardon the sort of pun. And probably enable me to go out the door a little bit more without just jumping into the world completely just because I've had an antibody positive test.
Yeah, it'd be nicer if there was a vaccine that we knew worked and you could have that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, caution at all times, I guess, especially if you've confronted death twice and preferably maybe for a third time.
Yeah, three times, actually.
Three times?
Yes. this is not the place to go into it. But
okay.
My family's favourite story, but a hotel fell on me and my brothers when I was four.
Oh, yes.
In Spain.
Oh, my gosh.
So actually, weirdly, Tilly, I was four then, I was 28 when I had cancer, and I was 52 when I had double pneumonia and dodgy heart. So at 76, something's going to happen.
Every 24 years.
That's really
every
weird.
24 years.
That is weird. It's a bit scary.
I know. I mean, if I'm still alive at 76, that would be a miracle anyway. So we'll see what happens.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
It's important, that four-year-old thing, because I'm quite blasé about death, but not because I underestimate it. That enables me to talk about it, A, in my work, where I can talk about taboo subjects and do plays about women dying of cancer, which I did a few years ago. But it's absolutely broken the taboo of death. So even when I was in hospital recently, people would say, oh, you must be really scared. And I was like, well, no, I'm not scared. I don't want to be ill. I hate being in hospital. I hate feeling unwell. But it's not the fear of death that scares me. It's the fear of not getting out of hospital.
Yeah, like it's the uncomfortableness.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah, and then it's, you're so right, Raz, that the gift of being able to speak about the unspeakable is actually so cathartic and therapeutic and makes people feel better. So being willing to do that is a gift, really.
Yeah, and this is awful, awful pandemic. As we're seeing, it's anyone and everyone is getting this thing, and anyone and everyone, sadly, is dying from this thing. And families who totally unexpectedly get someone in bereavement in their family and all that kind of stuff, it's just new, horrible and difficult. And if you can help one person by talking to them about it.
Yeah,
that's a really good thing.
By me. It's got deep, hasn't it?
I know. I've got the snorkels on.
I'm such a young person expression. Yeah, I like that. That's a really good expression.
Put on your snorkels, guys.
You can use it in your next book.
I will.
So your first book was Death and the Elephant, How Cancer Saved My Life, published by Unbound. Yes. Everybody should buy it.
Thank you.
Now let's hear about the next book.
Well, the next one's very different. Because when I first wrote the first draft of the book, I wrote it in two parts. I wrote the 28-year-old me back then and the 50-year-old me now. And it didn't quite work that way because the 28-year-old voice wasn't completely authentic because I hadn't written the book then and it didn't. But I did write a couple of letters from the 28-year-old to the 50-year-old, whereas the 50-year-old was giving the 28-year-old advice about what the future would be. And the 28-year-old was full of dread and optimism for the future. So I thought about writing a fictional version of that book. In the meantime, for some strange reason, I'm writing a book called Me and My Psychic Dog. It is a tale of a 12-year-old girl with Down syndrome fighting crimes with her dog.
Oh, wow.
I've got many godchildren, about 10 or something, I've lost count.
The godfather.
And one of my brilliant godchildren is 9 years old and she has Down syndrome and we are very close. My full name to her is Raz, my best friend ever.
Oh,
I think it's quite a catchy name.
It is. It's so cute.
And it was sort of in honour of her because she's so brilliant. She does so many amazing things.
What's her name?
Her name is Larkin.
Oh.
And she's brilliant and funny and she's fearless. She horse rides. She's fearless. And I just wanted to talk about positivity. I wanted to write something about a young woman. The outside world might look at her and think she had challenges, but actually she doesn't think that. She knows she's got a 47th chromosome. As far as she's concerned, that's just her, and that's a positive rather than a challenge. And she jumps into life.
Yeah, she's having a brilliant time.
Actually, she was really ill when she was younger. She's got, I think there's lots of generic illnesses that children with Down syndrome often have. So she had 16 pneumonias.
Gosh.
She had heart surgery when she was 4 weeks old. She had all these things, but she's just an amazing young girl. And it was inspired by her spirit. That's what I'm doing at the moment.
Oh, wow. And is it going well? Because I know we've talked about it in the past, sort of prior, you know, ages ago, actually. It's been a little idea in your head. Is it going as well as you hoped?
I've written 14,000 words. It'd be about 100,000 words in the end, so whatever that is.
Gosh, yeah, 15%.
What I know I can do is write her voice, because it's a first-person book.
Okay.
It's interesting the difference between the words go from her brain to her mouth slightly slower because of the obstacles in the way. in my book, I call it, there's a trampoline in the way that sends the words back. So she has to be a bit more careful and sometimes slightly slower and stuff. But actually, her thoughts work the same time as anyone else. So it's interesting trying to find that voice on paper.
Yeah, I bet.
They talk to each other, her and her dog, in their heads. And whether that's real or imagined is up to the reader, I guess. And the challenge is trying to find the plot, simply.
Great. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
One question I wanted to ask from the things we already talked about was, what are your top three musical theatre albums that you like walking along your road to?
Really difficult question, especially as someone who's quite new, weirdly, considering how very old I am, to directing musicals. The things that I might want to direct musical-wise, which are normally new stuff, is different to the things that entertain me on my 47-minute walk. So I would say at the moment is Mary Poppins. Come on. Everyone needs a little bit of Mary Poppins in the morning.
Are you talking about the movie one with Emily Blunt?
No, I'm talking about the original movie. The older people like me think the movie.
Yeah.
It's the only one. Although I think the Emily Blunt one is actually quite good. But actually, not to be a musical theatre bore, the lyrics in that, if you listen to the lyrics, they're actually really good lyrics.
Are they?
You don't think that when you think about Mary Poppins.
Chim chiminy.
Telefragilistic.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
It is actually genius.
Okay. We'll put Mary Poppins on our list.
Avenue Q is a good one.
Avenue Q, yeah.
Obvious one is Hamilton. It's quite fun.
Oh, uplifting. Yeah, pretty bouncy.
Pretty bouncy. And embarrassing, the one I keep going back to because it's like my youth. In my youth, I knew every word. And I still know every word, which is embarrassing if you see me mouth it as I'm walking up and down the road like an eccentric strange person.
What is it?
Is Joseph.
Oh, the music in Joseph is fantastic, isn't it?
It's so good.
Yeah, did you do it at school?
No, I don't think so. But from when I can remember, and I remember being in some Christmas cottage with some friends when we were supposed to be quite cool at like 17, but all singing Joseph. I mean, how, we clearly weren't cool at all.
No.
No. Thanks, Tilly. But yes, it's great. I genuinely think, I'm a bit of an Evita fan, but I genuinely think that's Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's best musical.
Yeah.
Say No to Jesus Christ, Superstar.
I love that one. No, I'm not that fond of it.
They're both brilliant, but...
It is kind of banging, but Joseph is great. Yeah. Anyway.
It is.
There's ruined any street cred, not that I had any before. I will never have any again.
Don't worry.
Thank you for ruining my life and my career.
People will be loving those recommendations. Once they've had a listen, they're going to think you're a god, aren't they?
Good. Although it's a Chicago I listened to yesterday. Oh, the music is so good in Chicago.
Oh, it is actually.
Anyway, and it's got my song that would be at my memorial service. Give them the old Razzle Dazzle.
Ah, of course. Razzle Dazzle.
That was always because I wrote my memorial service when I was ill with cancer. Because that's a dramatic theatrical thing you can do.
Yeah.
The aim was to get people weeping. And if they hadn't wept by the end, I'd play Give Them the Old Razzle Dazzle as they walked out.
Would that make them cry?
That would make them cry.
I didn't realise it was such a musical theatre geek, actually.
Oh, my goodness. It's not really a secret, but yeah.
Yeah. Rivals my Harold Pinter geekery.
Well, exactly. And weirdly, I only directed my first musical a year ago or 18 months ago, whenever it was.
Yeah, so, brilliant it was.
Thank you.
The producers at the Manchester Royal Exchange.
There you go.
Okay, well, I think I've run out of questions, Raz.
I'm so sorry for all the rambling talk I've done.
No, it was brilliant talking.
You can edit. How can we edit this down for like 12 minutes?
No, it'll be fine. It's 60 minutes now. It was absolutely brilliant. And you're such a great talker. That's why we wanted you on. Oh, Tilly had one more question.
Oh, yeah.
Go, Tills.
What are you most excited about for you to do when lockdown is over?
Excited. That's not a word I'd often use with myself.
Okay, let's go for it. What are you feeling most positive about doing when lockdown is over?
I miss going to restaurants with some close friends of mine, but it's just something that feels like it was always a treat that we do once every few months. And I'll look forward to that. Yeah. It's really genuinely just hanging out with friends,
or
not just standing in my prison railings bar, but, you know, going and seeing them and
enjoying their faces.
Yeah,
exactly.
Cannot wait for that.
I literally can't wait. But then again, I'm confused in my at-risk state about when I'm comfortable enough to actually go out properly.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually when I was thinking about what we were going to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, even when we heard the confused statement from our darling Prime Minister, to me that it depressed me even more, partly because of the indecision, but also because it didn't really apply to me. You know, people like me who are either on the list or at risk for whatever reason, we're not just going to suddenly go out into the world.
Yeah, you can't just pop out.
Yeah, and the more people get on with life as normal, when I think we've got to be careful that we're not doing it too quickly, the less I see my desire to go out. And so I think I got a little depressed around, as a lot of people did around the Boris statement, because it was so unclear and unthought out.
Yeah, yeah.
And felt a little bit dangerous in terms of just releasing people too early. Yeah. That people like me, who don't really worry about things like that normally, as we've just talked about, death is not a taboo to me, but I suddenly got anxious about, will I ever feel comfortable to walk out into the world?
And it is an unknown, isn't it, sadly, still, because we understand so little about the virus still, relatively, really.
Exactly.
You could have the antibody test. We don't know whether that will make you immune to getting the virus.
Totally.
You could wait until the number of cases goes down, but we don't know when that's going to be.
No.
We could wait until there's a vaccine, but we don't know when that's going to be. So
no, and it feels like, not to get too political, but it feels like people are playing a little bit too fast and loose with people's lives.
Mm.
And that doesn't feel great, you know, but it feels like there's too much attention going on about the economy put over people's well-being and their lives.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel great.
If lots of people are dying, then that has major impacts on the economy itself anyway.
It's like a vicious circle.
Yeah, yeah. And it does seem a bit unfair to put the onus onto the people to decide rather than giving clear guidelines.
With the right info.
Totally.
Yeah, there needs to be a bit more transparency with the whole thing.
Having been a newly refreshed, positive person.
Yeah.
As Noel Coward said in his song, there are bad times just around the corner. I mean, there are good times just around the corner.
Exactly.
No snorkeling here. What is it?
Yeah, correct. We haven't got the snorkels on. We're sunbathing at the moment above the water.
Goodness. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And on that note,
a fresh positive actor.
Let's sunbathe our way
out of lockdown.
Oh my god. Okay. Well, it's been a delight.
Yes, thank you so much, Raz. It was great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for telling us.
I apologise for my talking.
No, your talking was brilliant, and it was great to hear about all the taboos.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Raz for speaking to us. I really, really enjoyed that interview/chat.
Yes, thank you so much, Razzle Dazzle.
Yep, I really enjoyed, I don't know, I feel like sometimes confronting the kind of unspeakable topics is actually a really positive thing you can do. Like in my kind of, as an actor, that's something that you look at quite a lot. And obviously he does as well with his directing. So I really enjoyed that element of it.
Yeah, I'd really like to think that our podcast helps people to start talking about these things that are actually much scarier, like we've said in the past, actually. They're much scarier when you don't talk about these things.
Yep, than when you do.
Yep, and with a sort of good-humoured, light-hearted approach. I know lots of people are going through a terrible time at the moment, and they have done recently, perhaps because of being ill themselves or having relatives who are very unwell. I think it does really help to have this kind of direct, light-hearted, good-humoured approach. You know, it's how I think we as human beings with our human psychology get through lots of things.
Yeah, and it's such, I guess, death is quite a thing that is looming over us at the moment with this virus and the lockdown.
Yep. I also would like to pick up on how it was like kind of comforting as an artist when I thought about, for me, when I thought about him being a director and like how in my head it was just a disaster that he was suddenly kind of, which I did ask him about, like into lockdown, not being able to be hands-on, but he was actually so positive about it and it turned out he was still doing so much stuff.
Yeah, really so great work.
It was really, really nice to hear that.
Yeah. Super positive, like we said. Getting the snorkels on was great. Yeah. So yeah, just to say about his book again, it's Death and the Elephant, How Cancer Saved My Life, and it's published by Unbound.
Yep. And now on to positive news. So I actually read a book a while ago by a journalist called Dolly Alderton called Everything I Know About Love. I loved it. You should read it. It's nonfiction. And there's a recipe in it that I read ages ago and I've wanted to try it for so long. It's a macaroni cheese recipe, but it's called hungover mac and cheese. And I really, really love mac and cheese as a dish. It's like one of my faves and I really want to try it. And I gave the book to Mum after I finished it and she read it and really liked it.
So I loved it.
As in lockdown, I feel like it's an opportunity to try these things that you kind of want to do in the back of your head that you never get around to, like something like this. We did it the other day, didn't we?
Yeah, we finally made Dolly Alderton's mac and cheese.
Yep, and it was the cheesiest thing ever.
It had like pounds of cheese.
Yeah, different types, Red Leicester, cheddar, parmesan, mozzarella.
Yeah.
Honestly.
All of them.
We kept like looking back at the recipe like, really? This is
definitely
much
the right amount.
Yeah, definitely is. Okay, let's keep going.
Yeah.
So yummy though.
Cheesiest mac and cheese in the world.
And I just feel accomplished now. Like I've done, that's been in my head. Like I'm going to make that this weekend. Never do. And now I've done it. I feel accomplished.
One of those things ticked off the list.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was really delicious, if sort of slightly artery blocking.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway,
you can see how it'd be great for a hangover though, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, and we can definitely recommend the book. It's absolutely brilliant. And my piece of positive news is about how excited I am about the runner beans that we've planted, even though they haven't even come above the ground yet. So we didn't buy plants, we just got the seeds on Tinternet, and so they're like magic beans that we've planted, and we're faithfully watering the ground every day. We planted them about 8 days ago.
Yeah,
and I'm just looking every day to see the little shoots coming up,
which have yet to appear, can I just say, and I'm not hearing the end of them.
I'm getting ridiculously excited about it.
Yeah.
My parents used to grow runner beans in our back garden when we were growing up, and the summer was always just full of runner beans at every meal. One of my dad's specialist recipes when he cooked for us was runner beans and bacon. It was some kind of Welsh specialty. and we used to love it. So I can't wait to eat runner beans and bacon, basically.
Cool. Well, yeah, you guys have heard it once. I'm going to hear it many times more off the podcast. But yeah, looking forward to our run of beans.
Lucky Tilly.
Yep. So that's it from us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much to Raz again for being on it.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. And please do follow, subscribe, rate, review on your usual podcast platform. Follow us at The Coronacast on Instagram and Twitter.
Or email us with any questions, comments, whatever. Get in touch at questions@coronacast.co.uk. That's our email.
And thank you so much for listening.
As always, lots of love.
Bye.
Bye.
Stay safe.